So that brings us to Michelle, who is going to introduce the next page.
Okay, papers 18 and 18A are the papers for the second part of the session today. Paper 18 contains feedback from the 2015 agenda consultation. Paper 18A provides an update on our progress in the impairment phase of the Goodwill and Impairment Project. Now, our plan in this part of the session is to ask the board to primarily focus on paper 18A on impairment. However, if board members have any specific questions on the analysis of the feedback in paper 18, please do ask them during this session. Now, as noted in previous meetings, the staff envisaged that the Goodwill and Impairment Project would be continuing in two concurrent phases. Under phase one, we would consider accounting for goodwill and other intangible assets in a business combination jointly with the FASB. Consequently, the possible next steps in that phase of the project will likely be discussed at our next meeting with the FASB, which we expect will be next month. Under phase two, which will run concurrently with phase one, we would consider improvements to the impairment requirements. Now, we expect these discussions will be mainly ISB-only discussions, so we would like to discuss the next steps in that phase of the project today. However, we'd also plan to seek the input on our impairment proposals at the meeting with the FASB. It's worth mentioning also that last Thursday, the FASB issued their exposure draft that proposes to simplify their impairment test for goodwill. So we may also, at the meeting with them, want to discuss the proposals in that exposure draft. So paper A lists the different approaches that we've been considering at past meetings, so it sort of brings them all together as we've been discussing different parts of the impairment phase at different meetings. And it also gives an update of the status of information or of the work collecting the information that board members ask for at the different meetings. And it also sets out the staff recommendations for possible next steps in the impairment phase. And those would be step one, to develop the PH approach further, as set out in paragraph 26. Step two would be to get feedback from the FASB and also the ASAF on the approaches being considered for improving the impairment requirements, and also to do some field testing and additional outreach with preparers and users, particularly about our disclosure approaches. And we also welcome any feedback you have on the ongoing research that we've summarised in paragraph 22 to 24 and Appendix A on the work that on the information requested by board members. So are board members supportive of the next steps in the project as outlined in paragraphs 26 to 28?
Okay. Can I just ask, is now the PH approach the only one we are seriously considering right now?
We've set out there's two objectives. We've got looking at different approaches on ways to simplify the impairment test,
yes,
which we set out. Addressing the too little too late, we're only looking at the PH approach,
okay,
but we're also looking at a number of disclosures to address the issue that the investors aren't receiving.
So we're looking at disclosures, we're looking at simplification of the test, and
yeah,
we're looking at the PH
approach, yes.
Jung-woo.
Thank you. May I ask a question on the Appendix A?
Pardon, sir?
Appendix A.
Yes.
I agree with your recommendation on the paragraph 26 and 8. It's okay. Yeah. But you provided a new research on the relative use of VIU and the fair value LCD by the ESMA. So, one question is, are there any explanations on how companies use calculate the VIU in that ESMA report?
I expect there will. I was particularly pulled out the information on who's using value in use and who's using fair value less cost of disposal, and also how then they are calculating the fair value less cost of disposal. Well, there is a lot more information in there, so I mean, if there's certain
I would like to see some kind of a detail how to calculate the VIU, because it looks like a black box. Every company uses their own calculation model to produce a VIU. However, in this appendix, you summarized very good some kind of a high level summary of how to calculate the fair value LCD. Some companies use a binding sales agreement. Some are using a kind of a comparable transaction. And also they're using some kind of DCF model. And there are some details on how to calculate the fair value LCD. But maybe both members would like to see more on the how to calculate the VIU rather than the fair value LCD.
Well, I think the difference with the value in use is it would be a discounted cash flow. So, I mean, I could bring back information on what kind of assumptions they're using. But I think with the fair value less cost of disposal, there's a number of different approaches, one being the discounted cash flow.
Yes. Another factor you have has in this summary is almost three quarters of the European insurers are using VIU for calculating their income. So that's a quite big, you know, important method to calculate the impairment. So that's why I'm saying this is very important.
Okay.
Mary.
Collection of miscellaneous observations throughout the paper. I'll start with the paragraph 12 in the one model approach. I apologize, I didn't have time to go back and look at some of the earlier feedback summaries. I'm not sure how much complexity comes from having the higher of value in use, the fair value cost of sale. I don't know that I'd put much emphasis or effort into this work stream unless it were identified as a very significant extra cost. It may be extra complexity in terms of explaining the model, but some of that comes back to the explaining, because I think fundamentally the explanation is you're writing off that piece you can't, you believe you will not recover, and these are just different methods for determining that amount. I don't believe that companies actually go through full-blown calculations of both amounts, because I think there are qualitative assessments that they can make in many instances that explain why they think X or Y is, you know, the higher and therefore the more appropriate one to use. So in terms of what we invest in, unless I'm forgetting some part of the feedback, I think I would de-emphasize the work effort in this area. Not abandon it, but de-emphasize the work effort in this area.
If I can just say, when we brought this analysis of the two models to you in an earlier paper, we brought to you a summary of the explanations that are in the basic conclusions in IAS 36, and how the board obviously looked very much at the rationale behind doing value and use versus fair value, and there are two schools of thought there, and obviously that the board at the time decided that it'd be better to have those both and go for a higher of. And I must say, I'm not sure whether it would be worth trying to go back and redebate those conceptual aspects, when a lot of the feedback I think we got was more about the practical application of
and I'm talking about the practical application.
Indeed, I agree.
The feedback was that this is a major source of complexity, and
Mary thinks it's a simple that they come to the conclusion which one is higher very quickly.
Yes.
And spend the time calculating that one.
Yeah.
And so that's one point. I'll save just a straight out. I can't get my brain around this to last. In paragraph 17 through 20, there are a number of improved disclosures, all of which sound to me, especially D1 and D2, really right on track for answering the feedback that we had from users of financial statements about what the information gap is. So that makes me very enthusiastic about pursuing those. But as we remember what some of our objectives are for research phases of projects, one is not just to identify possible responses to the problems that have been identified, but also to assess the cost and barriers. I think that means in this case, thinking about the feedback that you see in the GPF, that there's going to be a lot of resistance from preparers about trying to provide the disclosures described here. So I think that means we're going to need evidence from users about whether this is a nice to have or this is really critical and here's what I'm going to do with this information if I have it, because that will tell us some approximate data about benefit, and then it will allow us to test costs in terms of the commercial sensitivity, et cetera, that the preparers cite. So I think getting that information is going to be important, because on just reading it, I'm like, yep, this sounds like exactly the right kind of thing, but I think it's the cost benefits there. When we look in paragraph 26A at developing the pH, the headroom approach further, I had some questions about at least item 3, because it starts to feel like we're getting into specifying mechanics rather, you know, and it's not that we wouldn't have to specify mechanics if we did develop this as a specific requirement, but I'd worry less about specifying accounting conventions and more about trying to specify what we're trying to achieve. And the last, I just can't get my head around it, question. 14A, you know, everybody complains, and I understand why, about our requirement to use pre-tax rather than post-tax discount rate. If we move to post-tax rate applied to post-tax cash flows, aren't we in essence discounting tax cash flows, which is what we say in IS 12 we don't do? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think we're going to have to stop, look at that issue, and think about it before just saying it's a mechanical problem. Everybody says they can do post-tax, let's do post-tax, because it seems to be building in a pretty big contradiction to IS 12 into that.
Yeah. Mary, if I could just comment on your 26A point.
Yeah.
I understand what you're saying, getting into the mechanics, yeah. But at the beginning of it, it says to look at the likely behavioral incentives or effects.
Okay.
And so you kind of have to look at the mechanics to get back to it.
True.
And I think one of the big downsides of that approach is the cost or even the possibility of getting the data to.
Okay.
Do it.
Yeah. Martin?
Yeah. You know that I don't really like this pH approach. I only want to make a comment, because when I said last month, okay, that especially I would not like it if we don't update the pre-acquisition, and I think this on page 11, what we've seen, what is a not recognized goodwill, shows how volatile this not recognized goodwill is, and if we would not update this, really the consequences is, I think, not meaningful. And at least if you look, for example, in this on page 11, this was in Europe in 2018, a small number and then grew to a very big number. And then depending on when you calculate the pre-acquisition goodwill, you come to totally different conclusions. And therefore, I think this approach...
You want to make it a little bit more burdensome.
Sorry?
You want to make the approach even more burdensome.
No, I think it only makes sense if we update it. Because I think to suffer the cost, which is not a meaningful number, I think does not have any good. And you can see it on these numbers how volatile that is.
Philippe?
Thank you. I support the staff approach. I think it's a good work plan. It's worth exploring everything which is there. Like Marie, I think there will be a lot of resistance regarding certain of the disclosures which are contemplated, D1 and D2. But let's try. Regarding the disclosure of D3, paragraph 19, breakdown of goodwill, that is very useful, probably quite easy to do, because we should have the data. I think we could go further and ask that this disaggregated amount of goodwill be also explained by segments, how the amount is allocated to each segment of business, so that at least, at a minimum, even though there might not be too much comments on the performance, at least investors could compare how much goodwill there is in each segment and how the segment has been performing over time. It would be a first and very rough indication of whether the amount of goodwill by segment is being justified by the performance of the segment. I know that people can aggregate segments and CGUs, etc., in a way which maybe could kind of hide some of the underlying truths, but at least as a first level of disclosure, that would be not too difficult, not too burdensome, and a good basis for investors to start challenging management assumption about recoverability of goodwill.
Amaro?
Thanks, Hans. I do like Philippe. I think it's a good idea or how to progress with the project. I am just not clear what is your intention with users' feedback, because it's not mentioned in none of the steps here, paragraph 26, 27, and 28. So we talk about developing the model, we talk about getting feedback from FASB and ASAF, then we talk about getting feedback of the GPF. But of course, I know you have something in your mind and it's not mentioned here. And how about users? My perception of reading what you mentioned as approaches on the disclosure of key performance targets and when you bring additional information on the appendix, particularly on A6 and A7, is that most of the information that staff have in mind about what should be disclosed in qualitative and quantitative terms is somewhat presented to investors outside of the financial reporting sometimes, and sometimes inside, depending on the, of course, I guess, the relevance of the transaction or the relevance of the numbers. But so can you tell us what's the idea of users here? Because they are not mentioned in any of those steps.
I'm actually in step three, as part of the field testing and additional outreach, it would involve preparers and users. So we'd also be discussing the disclosures proposals with users.
Yeah, it's not clear here because we say that field testing would be, yeah, you mentioned users, but I would expect field tests to be much more with preparers.
Yeah.
And feedback would be with users, what they really want to get.
Yes, well, that would include outreach with users, so I'll make sure that's included.
Very clearly. Thank you.
Gary? Thank you. Just a handful of comments, most of which you and I discussed yesterday. I think, actually, in general, I'm okay with your recommendations for the next steps forward, but starting with pre-acquisition headroom, as you know, I've, similar to Martin, I've got reservations about it because I do think it has to be updated, you know, but if we're trying to simplify this work, that just replaces one complexity with another one. But I think since business organizations are dynamic, I mean, things change. So the static number of the date of acquisition does not remain static. But as you pursue it, there's going to be situations where, in fact, the pre-acquisition headroom should count towards goodwill and not be excluded. If you think of an acquisition as just another piece of the puzzle that you're trying to work as a unitary group, yeah, the pre-acquisition goodwill and the piece of the puzzle you just bought to make it work as a better unitary group, maybe some of that goodwill should be available, mm-hmm. you know, in there. Again, I don't know how you might do it, but if we're going to be researching the outreach, I think that should be a part of the questions they're at. Another thing is, this is, you know, it's still, I know what we're working in here, but when you kind of step back, you're still wondering what is the problem we're trying to solve. To my way of thinking, the problem trying to solve is really approaches D1 and D2. There's just not enough information provided about how successful or lack thereof an acquisition was. Mm-hmm. You'd say, okay, well, if you have an impairment charge, that's certainly evidence. Not only is the acquisition not performing, but it's, given the way the models work, it's not even coming close to performing as expected. But seems to me that's sort of like really heavy-handed way of providing information about how an acquisition is doing, because it really is an all or a nothing and it's long after the fact. So I happen to really be a fan of whether it's D1, D2 or something like that, but I think if I would agree, we should probably have a round table or working group or something on it with preparers, but I think the question's got to be posed kind of like operating segments. What does the CEO see? You know, is, I mean, and every company will be different, but if the objective of the disclosure is provide useful information to investors of how well an acquisition is performing, whether it's against the targets, whether it's against actuals, whether it's against something else, the objective is quantitative information about how well is it performing. And by default, what's not viewed as part of the acquisition is the rest of the company. So you can, if you, you know, get a little bit aggressive or sporty on how well an acquisition is performing, by default, the rest of the company, it's got to come out of someplace. It comes out of the beginning operation. So I really think D1, D2, or an operating segment approach really needs to be worked hard. And I think if we had a round table or private, say, let's say, preparers, the question is not so much can you do it? The answer is, let's assume it is going to be required. How would you do it? And I think what goes to the top of the house, the CODM, becomes a logical starting point. But every company will be different, but it still gives information about how is an acquisition performing. That won't help well for smaller ones that are just six levels down, but it certainly would help on the major ones.
So. I was just going to ask a question on paragraph 23 in the paper about information about the timing of goodwill impairments relative to the related business combination. Because when I looked at the study that you mentioned at the in paragraph 85, and I know you've summarised it in a sentence, but that's just about how quickly it happens. It doesn't really tell us whether that was the right time or the wrong time or whatever. It's just could be too soon. And I'm just not sure how useful that is. Mm-hmm. And I know that's all you've managed to find. But then did we really say we just wanted to know how quickly it happens? Because that doesn't really tell us anything about whether the timing's right or not. So I'm just not sure whether we really need that information.
Well, there are a number of studies that look at timing to say if there are indicators that acquisition that an overpayment was made, and they look at if some of those indicators were present, how soon was the impairment in relation to entities that didn't have those indicators. There's that kind of information out there, but there isn't a lot information looking specifically at the timing, but like you say, whether or not it'd be useful.
Yeah, because surely the more interesting information, if you could get it, would be whether the whether there's economic indicators of an impairment and then the timing of the accounting impairment relative to that.
Yeah.
But that seems to be slightly different to what we're saying here. We've asked you to look at.
And so I wonder whether
how quickly it happens after a business combination.
Yeah. And I wonder whether sort of the what might be quite or very useful information is in terms of, you know, is it too slow, the impairment? It is a company by company examination that would be needed.
Picking the data.
I think so, because looking at it on a portfolio basis, a large basis, I'm not sure that we would necessarily get particularly useful information.
So I think we're sort of working on the assumption at the moment that things are not done on a timely basis and it tends to be too little too late, which is, people will tell us whether that's good or bad, I guess.
Well, I think the reason why we wanted the information collected was when we were looking at the indicator approach, it was whether or not it was more important to have more robust indicators in the early years following the acquisition. It's whether there's any other information we could collect to give us any kind of information about.
Yeah, where was your indicator approach in the next steps?
In approach A2, I2, paragraph 13.
Okay. So I think the staff can take the comments on board and continue with its work.
Yeah.
I don't think we need to vote.
No, there is one thing, though, that I think we should just make sure we do consciously touch on. In paper 18, we include the feedback from the gender consultation. Now, obviously, we've been talking just now about what we are doing. What we've not talked about is what we're not doing. And what I mean by that is, starting from paragraph 24 of paper 18, we have the feedback from the gender consultation, including those areas from the post-implementation review that at the end of the PIR you didn't rank as being of higher significance, but as medium or lower significance, and therefore didn't add to your agenda at that time. Now, we've provided some analysis here of the feedback, and our conclusion based on the feedback from the agenda consultation is that there isn't anything new coming out of that that would lead us to recommend that we add any more of those additional items, those further items, to your agenda. But I just wanted to flag that and make sure that it was consciously considered, brought to your attention as part of this discussion.
Stephen? Is that because you don't think they are issues at all with current accounting and that the accounting's fine, or is it a capacity thing, a priority thing?
It's a relative priorities thing. So, you know, just as we did that same relative priority assessment at the end of the PIR, there's nothing that we heard through the agenda consultation which would lead us to change those judgments.
Michael, just to follow up on yesterday's discussion about variable consideration being paid, is that part of paragraph 27 about substantive accounting for contingent consideration? I don't remember if we decided if that was part of that project or outside it. I just
no. The point that we've got here in here on paper 18 is about specifically in business combinations. What we were talking about yesterday was specifically outside of business combinations.
Okay, I just didn't remember if it was in or out.
But
I know there are different subjects. I just didn't remember.
But we did think, and Sue raised the point about that we might use as a starting point looking at, well, what is the accounting in a business combination? And so we might sort of bring in some of this feedback to inform us for that other project.
But Michael, if the conclusions of the work on asset acquisition outside business combinations are such that they could call into question the accounting in business combination, is there any feedback loop of that work on asset acquisition that could potentially lead us to rethink some of the business combinations accounting?
And, you know, that would be something that I think would be worth considering in that other project as that progresses, to see what do we learn about it. So just as business combinations could help inform that project could also tell us a little bit more, add to the information that we've already got from the PIR.
Just a quick one, kind of a follow-up on Steve's question. One message I got very clearly covered in paragraph 29 is the user's desire for more pro forma information. Maybe one of the things we should do is collect in more detail than we have in this paper the feedback we had and make sure we communicate it to IOSCO, because that seems to sit on the boundary of things that we do in financial statements and things they might do outside of financial statements. I'm not sure whether they'd want to action it or not, but it seems particularly relevant that they be informed of what we learned.
I think for these other PIR items, sorry, just going back to that point, I think it's quite important that we send out a clear message about what we do, because I think we actually left it a little bit in limbo after the last feedback statement. And it seems to me it's one of two messages. One message would be these are things that we think we will come to at some stage over the next 3 to 5 years. Exactly when we do it will depend on relative priorities and so on. Or the other message would be we don't expect to get to them into the next 3 to 5 years, and they'll go in the pot with everything else at the next agenda consultation. But I think we ought to be clear one way or the other, because otherwise we just leave people confused.
A letter?
That's the way I would go.
I think if we would say the first, it would probably end up being the letter.
Well, I think we ought to be clear one way or the other anyway. That's
kind of 24A, but sorry, the paper on way forward. But
okay. Staff continues with its work, and we look forward to new products. And, before we take a break for lunch, we get an update on revenue by Henry.